I'm Larry Mullins, host of the podcast Your Weirdest Fears, the show that explores the odd things that make your heart stop.
I am so scared of the Grinch. He is bad vibes.
We talk to everyone from therapists to exterminators to lizard man.
I was 25 when I actually got my tongue split. I have one tattoo that covers my entire body.
Listen and subscribe on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts from.
The listening you love is on the free Odyssey app. Your trusted local radio stations, coverage of your favorite teams, live news from your hometown, and millions of podcasts on demand. Best of all, you can completely customize your listening experience. Follow topics you care about, like leagues and teams. Pause or rewind your local sports and news, and add shows to your queue to catch up later. There's a lot to listen to, so get started and download the free Odyssey app today.
Meth has been called a number of things. I've cursed it throughout my entire educational life. I didn't like it much. It wasn't good to me. It was difficult. Recently, a Vanderbilt mathematics professor, Louis Leva, called college math a white, cis-hetero-patriarchal space. I'm not sure what that means. I'm not sure you do either, and I'm certain that we are all mystified. But William Jacobson, a clinical professor and director of securities law at Cornell University and the founder of the website LegalInsurrection.com, you want to check that website out, folks. It follows the craziness of what's going on in American educational system today, and he joins us. Mr. Jacobson, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on.
So, I mean, math has been called racist. It's been called all kinds of different things. How did we get to this point?
Well, as you indicated, math is hard, okay? I struggled. I barely got through high school trigonometry, and I said, I've had enough, okay? But what I the only thing I thought at the time was, you know, maybe I'm not smart enough to do advanced math. I can do other things. I didn't think I was a victim, okay, because in this 1970s, not everybody was a victim. Now everybody's a victim. So if you're bad at math, it's not your fault. It's society has wronged you. The structure has wronged you. And that's really what's taken over. It's a victim mentality that permeates higher education, increasingly K through 12, but higher education. And everything has to be put in a context. There's always a race connection. There's always a gender and sex connection. There's always a, you know, capitalist connection. There's always something other than the fact that you just can't, are not good at math. And that's what's happened. And that's, it permeates. It's really hard to overstate for your listeners how absurd it has become throughout higher education.
Has this conversation, dialogue, rhetoric, is it linked to what's kind of the trend of what's happening with race-based affirmative action?
I think it's completely independent of that, because there's so many areas of academia that have turned into absurd word salads. So just, you know, people who want to get their PhDs, who want to get promoted and come up with bizarre theories. I don't think it has anything to do with affirmative action. I do think it has to do with what's commonly called woke ideology, commonly, you know, referred to as trying to examine the systems that we have and dismantle them and tear them down. And so that's how you get advanced. I mean, this person, I read the abstract of his lecture. And, of course, it's just it's literally word salad. I mean, it's repeating the same things over and over again. And it's the sort of nonsense you see in, you know, throughout academia, particularly in the humanities. What makes this so interesting is that it's actually in math. This is the sort of nonsense you expect to see in the humanities.
Well, I read, you know, an article a while back about an organization called Teaching Works. And I think the Gates Foundation provides a lot of the funding for it. And the founder said that math is a harbor for whiteness, and the very nature of the knowledge and who produced it and what is counted as mathematics is itself dominated by whiteness and racism. But if you go back through history as it relates to math, it never really was dominated by whiteness, was it?
Well, I'm not a historian of math, but, you know, I think there were other civilizations, you know, not so-called non-white, non-European civilizations, which were quite advanced in mathematical concepts, you know, throughout the Arab world, I believe, you know, China, elsewhere. So, no, I mean, math is not a white thing. It's just math. And the fact that it's now being portrayed that way is, one, historically wrong. Two, it's presently wrong because everybody on a math test is treated equally. They're dealing with the same playing field. And, you know, it's also very insulting what it is. It's suggesting that if you're not white, you can't be doing math. And we know that that's not true also. So at every level, this attempt to portray mathematics as a white thing is just wrong.
So, you know, I've read, and I'm sure you have too, that identifying incorrect answers as being wrong is demeaning to students, and therefore this quest for being right is a white-dominated aspect of life as well.
Yeah, I mean, you see that all the time. You see that sort of thing in trainings. You see that anecdotally in videos that are released, or somebody secretly records something. You see that everywhere. And again, what message is that sending to non-white children that if you're punctual, if you turn in your work on time, if you you know, are correct in your mathematics and you're able to show your proof and you're able to do all these things that make you successful in life and in this society, and then they tell them, but if you're doing that, that's a sign of whiteness. What message is that sending? There's something has gone so fundamentally wrong with our education system and teachers and book publishers and foundations who view education as a method of activism, of social activism. And that's how you get into these ridiculous, insulting concepts, which are, you know, demeaning to people they pretend to be helping.
I try to put myself in, you know, from the perspective of a student. If I'm sitting in a class and I'm listening to this individual at the front of the class, you know, perpetuating this theory, and I wonder what my reaction would be. Well, I know what it would be. What is the reaction of students today? I mean, are they buying this message?
Well, some are. I mean, there's no question some are, but I don't think it's anywhere near the majority. And both from my anecdotal interactions with students, because I teach at a university, but also from survey data, there are various groups that survey students. And something approaching 70% of students on campuses feel afraid to express their viewpoint on campus. So most students that I encounter, and the survey data supports it, really just want to keep their heads down. They don't want to speak out. They don't want to be targeted on social media. They don't want to be called names on social media. That could hurt their job prospects because most employers, maybe every employer this day, you know, before they even interview you, they have somebody go search the internet for you. And if there's bad things said about you, even if they're completely false, you probably won't get the interview or you won't get hired. So I think there's a pervasive fear on campuses of damage to reputation, of social standing damage, if you speak out against this. And, you know, there's that 10% who are able to control the 90% because the 10% are just very aggressive. And this is the sort of dynamic that this professor is spouting, or the people who refer to math as whiteness and things like that, that, you know, is really contributes to that atmosphere of fear that pervades so many campuses.
We're speaking with William A. Jacobson, clinical professor and director of Securities Law Clinic at Cornell University and the founder of the website legalinsurrection.com. You should really check it out, folks. You know, in my educational life, the classes that I enjoyed the most was the Socratic method of teaching, challenging thought. That's dead, right?
Well, you know, I attended law school in the early 1980s. The Socratic method was how the classes were taught. The professor pressing you, calling on you. You didn't know you were going to be called on, so you had to be ready for every class because you didn't know which – is this the day I'm going to get called on and challenge you and probe you And, you know, and so that's an uncomfortable sort of thing. But it was really good as a learning methodology because, one, it required you to be ready. You had to be ready at every moment. But, two, I think it was teaching people to get to an answer on their own, teaching people how to critically, self-critically examine what they're saying. Now, I think the Socratic method, even in law schools where it really started, is probably out the window in most places. And instead, because the concept is that you want people to be comfortable. You want them to feel safe in the classroom, intellectually safe in the classroom. You don't want to stress them. You don't want to embarrass them. But, you know, real life is a series of stresses and embarrassments and being prepared. So I think that the old Socratic method was great. Frankly, it was a lot more work for the professor, much easier to just get up there and lecture for an hour than to actually interrogate students.
It's almost as if professors now are engaging in confirmation bias, right? I mean, you're not going to do well in the class unless you confirm my biases. I mean, having taught at the university level myself, I mean, it's just something completely foreign to me.
Well, that's certainly the perception, okay? Now, a lot of the professors say, oh, no, no, I would never penalize somebody because they disagree with me. And maybe that's true, but there certainly is a perception out there from students that if the professor brings his or her politics, particularly things related to politics, into the classroom, I better agree with it or I'm in fear of getting a bad grade. Whether that's reality or perception, but I think it's probably it's definitely perception, and there may be a little bit of reality there. And that's why I think it's really unfortunate that all subjects, including mathematics, have now become so politicized. Everything is a social justice issue that it really, I think, is very intimidating to students.
So when I read this word salad, as you referred to it, and I think appropriately so, I never am able to pull out what it is that they're actually the conclusion of what it is that they're saying and how that translates into what they would change relative to the course of instruction of math.
It's funny you say that because that's what I thought when I read it. It's completely circular. Okay, he even cites to himself as authority for some of his points. And it never really tells you, at least what's online here, it never really tells you how is this going to improve students' ability to learn math. Maybe that's not the purpose of it. Maybe the purpose of it is to tear down various structures in the university system and in society. And I suspect that really is what the purpose is because that's what gets rewarded in academia. But there's nothing in here. You know, I would read it. It's too long to read right now, but it literally makes no sense. It's circular. It's just a bunch of words thrown together. And it really is. But this is what gets rewarded in academia. I think it was, I forget if it was University of Portland or some place in the Northwest as kind of a hoax sort of thing. Some anti-woke activists in academia submitted fictitious articles to various sociological publications with completely absurd themes to them just to see, like, would this actually get through a peer-reviewed journal? They just, like, made stuff up, like, completely absurd, like examining the interrelationship among dogs at dog parks and things like that and proving how dogs conduct at dog parks reflected much of the stuff this guy is saying, you know, the patriarchy, et cetera. And they got published. Of course, the professors then got fired for doing that. But their point was the stuff that gets through peer-reviewed academic journals these days, in many cases, is a pure joke. You could actually just make it up and it would pass muster. And so that's, you know, I don't know how we got here. Maybe it's that, you know, different people are competing for very few academic jobs and they feel they need to outdo each other in this stuff. But it's a really terrible situation.
And how do we connect this to, you know, the perpetuation of STEM education that we've really fallen behind when we compare ourselves to other industrialized countries as it relates to STEM, that we think we're going to end up in a better place?
Well, we're not. Right? I mean, and nobody who looks at this thinks this is actually good for our country. You know, and I always try to emphasize, because I speak to a lot of groups, I speak to a lot of legislators, I should say. And I say, you know, this stuff is funny at one level. I mean, we can sit here and we can kind of laugh at how stupid it is. But when you think that we are raising generations who don't know how to do math, who think that there's something wrong with showing your proof in math, and this is perpetuated throughout the other STEM subjects, we're really, you know, damaging ourselves as a nation. You know, if you had a long-term generational view to undermine the United States, how would you do it any differently than they're doing it now? You would create a nation of students who can't read, write, or do arithmetic, and we're not there yet. I mean, there are many bright students and there are many students who perform, but we're creating systems which seek to punish high achievement and seek to denigrate high achievement in racial and other terms that is extremely damaging to our country. So this is not just about some kooky professor at Vanderbilt who writes word salad. This is really, that's a symptom of a more fundamental problem.
Yeah, you know, the other day I talked about that issue in Virginia where they didn't post the national merit students. They didn't let them know in time for their college applications. And I happened to be talking to this Louisiana superintendent of education on the show. And I said, you know, I just find it odd because I attended a very high-performing high school. We had dozens of national merit finalists in our class. We were high-fiving them. We were excited for them. I was never going to get there, but I was excited about their success. And I just don't understand this culture where we can't be happy for people that achieve a millionaire status, achieve high educational scores and standards, and get scholarships to 28, 29, 30 colleges. I'm excited for those people. I don't understand why that's become such a negative thing.
Yeah, well, it's become in many ways the politics of envy. And I agree with you because the town that I live in Rhode Island, so I split the year between upstate New York and Rhode Island, is a very high-performing public school district. And I think we've won 23 or 24 of the last 25 state math competitions, our team. And everybody's happy about that. Everybody takes pride in that. That's a source of pride in the community. But that's not universal. That's not universally the case because there are people who think they can achieve political goals by denigrating that. And the question is not why are your students doing so well? It's why isn't somebody else doing so well? Another school district isn't doing as well. And that's somehow reflective of problems in our system as opposed to celebrating the students who do well.
Folks, you need to go to legalinsurrection.com. I check it out every day. I love the articles and the following of some of the craziness that's going on in education. We have to shine the light on this issue, or we will very much lose our educational system. And Mr. Jacobson, I don't know about you. I have grandkids. I worry. I worry every day about what they're going to be facing in 20 years.
Absolutely. I've got 5 grandchildren under 4 years old, so I worry about it also.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. We appreciate your time, your insight. Keep up the great work. Have a great weekend.
Take care. Thank you.
All righty, folks. That's William Jacobson, clinical professor and director of Securities Law Clinic at The Cornell University and founder of the website legalinsurrection.com. Give us a call, 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. It's No Filter Friday. We want to hear from you. We'll be right back.
The NFL playoffs live on Odyssey. And Westwood One brings you the AFC and NFC championship games. Streaming live for free this Sunday on the Odyssey app. The 49ers visit the Eagles.
Touchdown, Jalen Hurts.
Gives it to McCaffrey up the middle into the end zone.
And then it's a rematch between the Bengals and the Chiefs.
Wide open, Jamar Chase takes it in.
Touchdown, Chiefs.
Catch all the action from Westwood One. Your playoffs, your Odyssey. Get in the game and download the free Odyssey app today.
The listening you love is on the free Odyssey app. Your trusted local radio stations, coverage of your favorite teams, live news from your hometown, and millions of podcasts on demand. Best of all, you can completely customize your listening experience. Follow topics you care about, like leagues and teams. Pause or rewind your local sports and news, and add shows to your queue to catch up later. There's a lot to listen to, so get started and download the free Odyssey app today.
I'm Larry Mullins, host of the podcast Your Weirdest Fears, the show that explores the odd things that make your heart stop.
I am so scared of the Grinch. He is bad vibes. Yeah!
We talk to everyone, from therapists to exterminators to lizard man.
I was 25 when I actually got my tongue split. I have one tattoo that covers my entire body.
Listen and subscribe on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts from.
Some folks don't stop searching till they find the truth. If you've got a detective's eye, June's Journey is the game for you. Play as June Parker in a gripping murder mystery as you find hidden objects to help solve her sister's death. You'll hunt for clues in hundreds of beautifully illustrated scenes set in the roaring 20s. New chapters are added weekly. Find your first clue by downloading June's Journey today. Available on Android and iOS mobile devices, as well as on PC through Facebook Games.